Well, today we're in the second of what I found out in the first service will be three sermons on a Christian view of economics. I was planning on doing two, and boy, I really blew past the time, so I know I cut it off, so we're just going to have to make three of them. Last week, and I should say, this is all in answer to the question, what's going on in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, where the believers are selling everything they've got, laying it at the apostles' feet, and then it's distributed to people that are poor? Is that the way God's constructed his world to live in a kind of a socialist or communist utopia? And so last week, we looked at how God has constructed the world. It's God's world. He owns it all. He has determined the means by which prosperity and flourishing comes. Sincerely held beliefs that oppose God's ways will not bring flourishing, no matter how sincerely held. One key way of God's ways is human, fruitful stewardship of the earth's resources, as found in the creation mandate of Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 28. That being made in God's image means that God has given us both the earth and our human ingenuity to improve upon the created order. Last week, we also looked at the great human problem. The great human problem is sin and depravity. God had given this creation mandate before the fall. That mandate continues, but it is marred. It is messed up because every one of us is sinful. Romans 3:23, our memory verse for this month, say it with me, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All human beings, all human institutions are corrupt. Desperately so. So, exploitation and deceit mar the wonderful means God has provided for fruitful stewardship. This corruption extends not just to humans as individuals, but to every human institution, including corporations, governments, educational institutions, charitable organizations, and yes, even churches. Covetousness infects us all. The only answer to this is found in the gospel of Jesus Christ, wherein persons and human institutions are redeemed to a new way of thinking, of serving others, where property is valued as stored work, but where our affections are not on that property, but rather on the riches that are ours in Jesus Christ. So today, what we're going to look at is the God-designed role of government in an economy, and then next week we will look at our personal engagement in an economy. Now, at the outset here, I want to make three observations about economics. First, economics is a study of scarcity. The issue that there is always less of some things that people want. In a free economy, that's how pricing happens. It could be something ridiculous. I mean, you see once in a while at Christmas, children's toys get in particular demand, and all of a sudden people are buying and selling them for hundreds of dollars, and they're just a stuffed animal. What happens? Well, there's less of them than people want. And in a free economy, the pricing structure is how those scarce goods get allocated. In a controlled economy, things get even more scarce because people will not produce for no benefit. The government could demand that a particular Beanie Baby that's in demand by lots of people, that it be sold for 5 cents. Well, what that would mean is there would be less of them available. It is this scarcity that creates human innovation and ingenuity. Food is scarce in the sense that it's just not lying around waiting to be picked up and eaten. Even before the fall, human beings were called upon to subdue the earth, bringing forth its produce by ingenious and innovative work. So economics is, first of all, a study of scarcity. Secondly, it's a study of productivity. And here we need to think of something that I'll throw an economic term out to you and then explain it. We need to study the issue of opportunity cost. What that means is that when you have some stored work, let's say in the form of cash, you can literally use that for any of an infinite number of items. But once you have spent it on something, that means that it can't be spent on anything else ever again. That's opportunity cost. Once we spend our stored work on one thing, it cannot be spent on another. So whether we acknowledge it at the moment or not, every purchase we make, what we are saying when we make that purchase is that that is the best possible thing that could be bought at that moment. Whether it's crack cocaine or raw steel or a Snickers bar. Similarly, those who produce goods spend their stored work on what they believe will bring them the best possible return on their money. So the Mars company spends its stored work on chocolate and decides how much of that chocolate to put into Snickers bars. But once that stored work goes into Snickers bars, it is lost forever to the making of 6-foot-tall chocolate rabbits. Governments, the world over, think that they know best which things to spend money on. But history has revealed a million times over that it is the consumer who is the best guide in directing producers in where to invest their stored work. The government can do analysis after analysis to determine how many Snicker bars to make and how many 6-foot-tall chocolate rabbits to make, but there will be extreme shortages or extreme surpluses if the customer is not the one who decides that. Oh boy, we're getting, that's the moon. They're reporting from the moon. So economics is a study of scarcity, it's a study of productivity, and thirdly, we need to think of economics as a study not of good intentions that pull at the heartstrings, but as a study of making the most of our human stewardship to exercise dominion over the planet. You know, socialists like to say that they care, while free market people are selfish, but that's dead wrong. Let me give you two examples in the stories of India and China. In the late 20th century, both countries made fundamental changes to their economic policies to lessen government control and to grant greater market freedoms. 20 million people in India rose out of destitution in a decade. In China, think about this. In 1990, the number of people who lived on a dollar a day in China in 1990 was 374 million people. That number shrank to 128 million by 2004. It shrank to 82 million by 2014. And in 2018, that number is 16.8 million. From 374 million people living on a dollar a day, to 16.8 million people living on a dollar a day in 2018. No one, literally no one, is talking about how compassionate the freer market has been to India and China. Just as no one cared for decades that people there lived in abject poverty as a direct result of so-called compassionate socialism. Ironically, at the very time when two of the world's nations, who have been entrenched in poverty for centuries, are adopting free market solutions, the United States, the most prosperous nation in the world by many measures, seems to be embarking on a determined plan to impoverish its citizens by seizing ever more control of markets. So we ask the question, what is the role of government in an economy? We're going to begin our study by looking at the nation of Israel, where there were clear directions for a government and an economy. This is not to suggest that they are to be equated. The world of ancient Israel and our world are different, and they may demand different solutions. But the point that I want to make is that the problems were similar to the problems that we face, and the answers may be similar as well. Let's think first about the role of government in an economy in the protection of private property. A government exists in order to protect the private property of others so that it's not just somebody who's physically stronger taking the property of someone else. And this is evidenced in very clear ways in Scripture. Look at Deuteronomy 19:14. Do not move your neighbor's boundary stone set up by your predecessors in the inheritance you receive in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. I wish so much that I had brought you a picture, because they still have these boundary stones in Palestine, in the Palestinian territory, where plots of ground are marked out by boundary stones, and the goal is, this is saying this is someone's property, and if you move the boundary stone, you're saying you're seizing that piece of property, and it is a big, huge no-no to move the boundary stone. It's repeated in Deuteronomy 27:17. Cursed is anyone who moves their neighbor's boundary stone. Job 24:2. Proverbs 15:25. The Lord tears down the house of the proud, but he sets the widow's boundary stones in place. Proverbs 22:28. Do not move an ancient boundary stone. Proverbs 23:10. Do not move an ancient boundary stone. Over and over and over in the Bible, what is that saying? The role of government in Israel was to assure the protection of private property. A second means by which government did this, protected private property, was by establishing a system of just weights and measures. Deuteronomy 25:15, you must have accurate and honest weights and measures, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. Proverbs 20:10, differing weights and differing measures, the Lord detests them both. So the protection of private property was done, first of all, by the literal not moving of the boundary stones of property, but by having just weights and measures in the measuring out of goods and services. And then thirdly, by having judges that did not distort justice, having a legal system where everyone was equal under the law, that the wealthy person didn't get more justice than the poor person did. 2 Chronicles 19:7. Now the fear of the Lord be on you. Judge carefully, for with the Lord our God there is no injustice or partiality or bribery. What's being said there? Well, just as with God, there is no injustice, you can't bribe God, God doesn't show partiality, so human judges, in the protection of the private property of the citizens of ancient Israel, so judges should not have injustice or partiality or bribery. And in fact, in Micah chapter 3:11 and Micah 7:3, Micah, the prophet's indictment on the culture is that there are judges who are showing partiality and they have injustice because they're taking bribes to put one person in an advantageous place about private property over others. While we're on the subject of private property, I want to talk about a modern issue of today that probably existed in ancient Israel, but I don't see is addressed in the Bible, but was addressed in our Constitution. And that is, what is property? It's not just land, but also the issue of intellectual property. That is, the ownership of your own ideas. This is something that was very fundamental to the founding of the United States of America. In Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution, it says this: the Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. Our Congress passed the patent law of 1790 before they passed the Bill of Rights. The reason why they did that was that they knew the importance of the protection of private property, both in terms of land and in terms of intellectual property. Our own, Illinois' own Abraham Lincoln, called the patent system of the United States one of the three greatest advances in human history, surpassed only by the discovery of America and the printing press. Why did Lincoln say that? He said that because any system that encourages people to fruitful stewardship by innovation enables people to reap rewards for that innovation, and that's better than any specific innovation itself. It moves the idea of property more broadly. Yes, land, but also ideas. And the protection of them is what enables people to enrich themselves by serving others through fulfilling the creation mandate to have fruitful stewardship over the earth by innovation and ingenuity. The great killer of the free market is not the confiscation of wealth, as much as it is the destruction of the human spirit to create and innovate, to be a fruitful steward in God's world. Go anywhere where there is not a free market, where there is significant government control over the economy, and you will find a people that have lost their will, lost their spirit, lost their creativity, and they're spending all their time just trying to survive. Now, another issue that Israel had to deal with, that we have to deal with, is the problem of the concentration of wealth. You've probably heard that kind of talk these days about the 1% that owns so much and how what a bad thing that is. In fact, there was just in the news this week that Bill Gates now owns more farmland than anyone in the United States. This is a subset of what is called Price's Law. Anybody ever heard of Price's Law? Okay. Here's what it is, and I won't go into the history of it. There's an interesting history to Price's Law, but here's what Price said. 50% of the work in any operation will be accomplished by the square root of the number of workers. So, for example, let's say you have four workers in a company. 50% of the work will be accomplished by two, and 50% by the other two. But as you go up in scale, guess what happens? If you have nine workers, 50% of the work is done by three people. If you have 100 workers, 50% of the work is done by 10 people. And if you have a huge, massive corporation of 10,000 people, 10,000 workers, the square root of 10,000, 50% of the work is done by 100 of the people. And this applies in a whole vast range of endeavors in life. You can check it out in sports. You can check it out in work. You can check it out all over the place. It's a fascinating study. But what that means is that over time, if Price's Law holds, even in just a small way, even if it's not quite accurate, if just in a small way, over time, what this does is it concentrates both work and the reward of work in just a handful of people. And the Bible acknowledges that problem. It acknowledges that it's true. So how does ancient Israel solve this problem? How does God tell Israel to solve this problem? By a redistribution, but not of wealth, but of the means of making wealth. That's what needs to be redistributed, which in the case of Israel was land. So Leviticus chapter 25, what happened was that every 50 years, all the land that had been bought and sold reverted back to the original family. It wasn't taking the wealth that was gained by a person and handing it to that other person. It was taking the means of making wealth and putting it back at a reset, okay? And so what you have here is you'll consecrate the 50th year, proclaim liberty. It shall be a jubilee, that 50th year. In it you neither sow nor reap or grow of its what grows of itself or gather grapes from the undressed vines. It's a jubilee. It'll be holy to you. Verse 13, in this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. And if you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. You'll pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the jubilee, and he'll sell to you according to the number of years for crops. In other words, the price for buying the land or selling the land is based on how many years until the next jubilee. If it's 48 years till the next jubilee, the price is going to be higher than if there's 2 years until the next jubilee. Verse 16, if the years are many, you shall increase the price. If the years are few, you reduce the price. For it's the number of the crops that he is selling to you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. So what we need are Christians who can think in an innovative and creative way about how is it not that we redistribute wealth, but that we redistribute the means of making wealth, which is what they had in Israel. A third issue that the government in Israel, ancient Israel, had was a warning of the hazard of big government. There's a constant pull between security and freedom. A big government that has the, it's big enough to create a secure life for you is also big enough to take away your freedoms. And this was predicted in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when the people asked of the prophet Samuel, in fact, they didn't just ask, they demanded a king. We want a king like all the other nations around us, because when we get that king, he's going to make us secure because of the regional conflicts. He's going to help us. Samuel then told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and servants, and chariots and horses, and they'll run in front of his chariots. Instead of serving you on your farm, your sons, the means of your making money, is going to be stripped away from you and given to the king. Some he'll sign to be commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, others to plow his ground and reap his harvest on the royal estates. And still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots." And it's not, it's an equal opportunity thing. "He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. No longer will they be taking care of you and your family. They're gone. They're serving the king. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants." In other words, those who perform well in the government bureaucracy will be rewarded by the confiscation of property of you. "He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants." He's saying how bad it was to have a 10% tax rate. "Your male and female servants, the best of your cattle and donkeys, he'll take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks. You yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you on that day." There is always a tension between security and freedom. Quite often what people are asking for in security, they're not aware of where the freedoms are going to be taken. A fourth issue that the government in Israel, in ancient Israel, wrestled with was clear plans for caring for the needy. And here we have the answer in Leviticus 23:22. We'll talk a little bit about poverty in more detail in a moment, but here, the plan is, when you reap the harvest of your land, don't reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. Note that this is a plan which involves work, and it's not just make work. It has the potential for innovation and ingenuity. One could figure out systems by which you could glean more grain than other systems, right? And so it had a potential to train those who were poor in being able to be better workers, better stewards of God's creation. This gives the poor dignity and a pathway forward. Not just some make-work thing. It's real work that requires ingenuity and innovation and trains them in fruitful stewardship. So these were four things that ancient Israel was given instruction by the Lord on the role of government: the protection of private property, dealing with the problem of the concentration of wealth, warning of the hazard of big government, and clear plans for the caring of the needy. There are other things that are not addressed, to my knowledge, in the Old Testament or in the life of ancient Israel, but still are problems that we as Christians have to think about in the government's role in an economy. For example, the larger the government is, the more it has the capacity to choose winners and losers. And it does that through subsidies or taxes. This is a subset of the biblical principle of sowing and reaping. Whatever a government taxes, you will get less of, and whatever it subsidizes, you will get more of. So, if you tax small business and highly regulate those businesses, you will get less of them. I want you to think about the Affordable Care Act for just a moment and the 50-employee threshold. There are literally thousands of small businesses all across our country that are not innovating to grow beyond that 50 employees because they know that it would create too big of a tension or too much of a financial burden on them to go beyond that 50 employee threshold. There, government has made a decision for them. On the other side, if the government subsidizes the cultivation of marijuana, or if it offers more unemployment money than one could make at a job, you will get more, much more, of that. People are not stupid. They will put their creativity and innovation to work to behave in their own interest, and government predictions and studies of how human beings will behave with proposed policies are notoriously bad predictors. During Bush 41's presidency, they passed a tax increase, and they wanted to make sure that the tax burden was placed on the wealthiest 1% of people. And so they are trying to think about, what do we tax that's going to get the rich person and isn't going to get the poor one? We know what it'll be. We will tax luxury yachts. And so luxury yachts that were manufactured in the United States were given a huge tax increase. But here's what happened. The wealthy people in America who wanted a yacht simply went overseas to buy their yachts. And the people and the yacht manufacturers here in the United States went out of business. And so who was it who paid that tax? It was the ordinary worker who put the yacht together that lost his job. That's the person who paid the greatest price. So we need to be aware, as Christians, in this impact that government has on choosing winners and losers by subsidies and taxation. By the way, while I'm on that subject, big companies generally like big government because it means that they are guaranteed their competitive position. So, for example, if you have a huge company, they have a whole cadre of lawyers and all that that can cope with all the regulatory issues, where a mom and pop business that just starts up as a competitor to that big corporation is going to have a harder time because they have the same kind of regulatory things to meet but they don't have the resourcing to be able to accomplish it. So larger companies, not wanting competitors in the marketplace, are going to generally be in favor of larger government because it guarantees their competitive position. Last week, when I talked about how the largest companies in the United States are going up and down all the time, there's the Fortune, top 10 Fortune companies in 1980 is different than the ones in 2000, it's different than the ones now. But if we have larger government, you will see less flow of change, and you will see less innovation and less prosperity. Another item that isn't, I don't believe, addressed in the Old Testament, but I think is nonetheless true in thinking about a Christian view of government, is that there are hidden taxes of product liability and government regulation. From instruction manuals to things that make stuff harder and more dangerous to deal with, to legal departments needed to check and defend lawsuits, to increased insurance premiums, liability costs are hidden in our economy. One pet peeve of mine is something simple, just the ordinary gas can. I used to have a gas can where you just flip the little thing up that gave, put the air in there and opened up and you just poured it in. Now you got these bells and whistles and slots and things, and I end up with gas all over the place, okay, where I never did before. But it's just an issue of regulatory, the hidden tax of regulatory environment. Government regulation has a crippling effect on the desire of people to put their stored work into more work. Wayne Grudem, in his book on business, The Christian View of Business, tells the story of Hernando Soto, who in his book, The Mystery of Capital, Why Capital Triumphs in the West and Fails Everywhere Else, tells the story of trying to open a garment shop with one worker in the country of Peru. They worked at the registration process 6 hours a day, and it took 289 days. The cost was $1,231, which is 31 times the minimum monthly wage in Peru, and the equivalent of 3 years of salary, all to start one business with one worker. To obtain legal authorization to build a house on state-owned land took 6 years and 11 months, requiring 207 administrative steps in 52 government offices. Obtaining legal title took 728 steps. So you see, when people say that we need protection from evil capitalists, this is what it ends up meaning. A system so filled with bureaucrats that it is all but impossible to start a new business legally. And big companies typically love that, by the way. The issue of security is real. The cost of that security is also real. In the third world, regulation and lack of property rights is such that no wealthy person openly puts their money at risk, because they know it's going to get stolen, bribed, regulated, and otherwise lost. So what do? The rich people move their money out of the country and often into ways of storing it that do no one any good at all, like buying a bunch of gold and putting it in a vault in Switzerland. We should want rich people. We should want them to feel freedom to put their money to work. We should be thankful when they succeed. We should be wary, of course, that the rich also are not immune to exploiting others. So that means we should seek to have equal protection under the law. Now, those were some things that ancient Israel addressed in the role of government, some things that were not addressed, and now I want to talk about two problems that are true in every culture that government seems to feel the burden to address. The first problem is the problem of poverty. Poverty is relative, both by nation, by our definition of a poverty line. The poverty line, as it was described in 1960, is very different than the poverty line described today. The poorest person in America today would be considered the wealthiest European duke of the 11th century. So poverty is a relative thing. A family of four in the United States qualifies for SNAP, which is the new term for food stamps, if they make less than $43,000 a year, and if they're over 60, $52,000 a year. Pastor Larry tells me that there are over 20 food banks here in McLean County that provide additional food in addition to this. There may be problems of getting people connected to resources, but people in America do not starve for lack of programs to alleviate hunger. And yet we are told over and over that one out of six Americans is hungry, and that in COVID, one out of four people may go hungry. Now, there's something found in Deuteronomy 15, which I find fascinating. On the one hand, there are verses at the beginning of Deuteronomy 15 that tells us that poverty could be eliminated. And there are verses a little later in Deuteronomy 15 that tell us it will always be with us. How is it that in the same chapter it says it could be eliminated, and yet it also says that it won't be? Let's look at the verses. Deuteronomy 15, 4 and 5 tell us that it could be eliminated. However, there need be no poor people among you. For the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you. The same blessings that we read at the beginning of the service in Deuteronomy 26. If only you fully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all these commandments I am giving you today. Poverty could be eliminated is what these verses say. But what's the qualifier? If you only fully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all his commands. Is that going to happen? That they're going to fully obey the Lord your God and careful to follow all the commands that he gave? No, they're not going to. So that's why we read a few more verses later in verses 10 and 11. Give generously to the poor and do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land. The issue of being able to care for those who need such care, that's important. Now, I'm going to say something rather dramatic. It won't make sense to some people, particularly people from a leftward tilt. But hear me out. Hear my explanation. The problem of poverty is not solved by money. The problem of poverty is not solved by money. Remember, if money is stored work, that would mean the confiscation of the stored work of others, or the printing of money, which devalues the currency, or borrowing money on the future work of others. That's not the solving of the problem. The problem of poverty is, first of all, a problem of a lack of opportunity. People raised in settings where the joy of fruitful stewardship is not caught or taught. Our work at Irving School has revealed this to us. From the weekend food that we distribute, not because there's a lack of food in Bloomington Normal, but because there are people who just don't have enough of motivation to be able to give their children food. To our children's Bible classes, to our tutoring. What is it that I think we need to add? I think we also need to teach the joy of fruitful stewardship, the creation or the Genesis 1 mandate. And this is different than the usual self-esteem talk in schools. Not just that you are special, but that you can produce something special by your labor and by serving your neighbor's needs, you can prosper. So the problem of poverty is a lack of opportunity. It's a lack of equipping, of educating, of teaching how every person can find their place in this world in a meaningful way to joyfully be a steward of God's creation. Secondly, the problem of poverty is a problem of embracing bankrupt values. It's a problem of embracing bankrupt values. Here are the values that are being taught the poor in the United States. Number one, you can have sex without consequence. People are being taught that. You can have sex without consequence. Secondly, recreational drug use is a means of happiness. We're teaching that. Thirdly, you can have prosperity without effort. And we promote that by state-run lotteries. And so when we have sex without consequence, recreational drug use as a means of happiness, and prosperity without effort, the blessings of Deuteronomy 28 are gone, and in its place are the curses, where God actually looks down from heaven, and even the good and right efforts we make, he withholds and withdraws his blessing. These blessings and curses are real, not just for the nation of Israel, but they have some application for all time, for both nations and individuals. God's moral laws of the universe are just as true as his physical laws. John Adams wrote, our second president, avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our Constitution is designed only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for any other. The proverb is true, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Now, sometimes it is true that poverty is the result of oppression. Sometimes it is true, and the effect of the depravity of man and the sinfulness of the human race poured down in particular effect, bringing about poverty. Sometimes it is the result of oppression. But we need to be careful to say that this is not true 100% of the time. That oppression can have different forms, from the person who charges excessive rents, to the school counselor that does not truly believe that students are capable, to the government that communicates that all needs will be met if only everybody stays under a threshold of achievement. All of those things are oppressive to the poor. Ironically, most successful elite liberals do not behave any differently than conservative people do. They get equipped for their world, they marry, they stay married, and they have children in that order. What is different is that the liberal elite believes that those things are only optional choices, and that sex without consequence, money without work, and drug use as a means of happiness are equally good ways of doing life. In my mind, that is deceiving the poor to remain so, bribing them with cheap and available abortion, so that they do not grow very large in number. I have no doubt that the elite liberal means well, though I do doubt that he thinks that I mean well. The plan of the elite liberal is a plan for perpetuating an underclass of impoverished but self-entitled people who think that they are not getting ahead because of the oppression around them. This, when infinite opportunity abounds if they simply take advantage of those opportunities. The second problem that I want to talk about in government's role in an economy is the problem of ruining the means to store work and the means of exchange by printing more money. What that means is when a government just prints money, money can no longer be used to store work. This came home to me when I lived in Israel. The year that I lived there, Israel had a 1,500% inflation rate. That meant if you took $10,000 at the beginning of the year and took it, put it into Israeli shekels, and at the end of the year you took it out of Israeli shekels and you put it back into U.S. dollars, that $10,000 became $1,500. So what happened was that everybody in the country of Israel at that time was working very hard to avoid having Israeli shekels and have some stable means of storing their wealth. And they came up with a rather ingenious way. Phone tokens. The tokens that were used to put into a payphone to make a phone call. The price of those tokens rose in proportion to the inflation rate. So what was it people did when they got their money? They went to the local post office, which is where the phone tokens were sold, and tried to buy as many phone tokens as they... I mean, everybody in the country had barrels full of phone tokens because it represented a stable currency, and you could not find a phone token in the country to make a phone call. Now, they soon changed that, and the inflation rate in Israel is now under control. But you see, those kinds of distortions happen when we think we can just print more money. Money no longer can be used to store work. And so we have a problem in our country of government debt, don't we? Federal, state, and local. And there's four ways to solve the problem. Print more money. We've already talked about how bad that is. You can borrow more against the future work. In other words, you just loan, you get people to loan you their stored work in the promise that you will pay them back in the future with the stored work of people that are going to do in the future. You can increase taxes to pay down the indebtedness, or you can cut spending. Of those four, we seem to be embarked upon the first two: print more money and borrow more against the future. That's because they are, at the moment, the least painful things politically, but they are the most dangerous things in the long term. I've said that money's not the answer to the problem of poverty. Otherwise, just printing money would solve the problem, as many are, in fact, proposing these days. But it's not money that's the problem. What makes a prosperous economy is the volume of goods and services. That determines whether you have a prosperous economy or not. Look, in Zimbabwe, you can have $600 billion notes on the currency, and they've got money printed everywhere. But the store shelves are empty. There's nothing to buy, and it don't even know what to charge. You couldn't have a pricing system. No, money is not the answer. When money is just printed and doled out, it reduces money as stored work. It reduces the value of each dollar that does not represent true work, and it promotes a false economic notion that the answer to poverty is giving people money that does not represent stored work. Now I'm going to get to a personal opinion here. So ignore what I'm about to say if you don't care about my personal opinion, okay? But it's just a personal opinion that I need to say. This is why I felt that the end of America had come with the adoption of the first stimulus package. Because at that moment, both the left and the right of our political officials had agreed on one thing: giving out money was the answer to impoverishment created by the pandemic. Now, what's happened is the function of government has shifted to caring for the welfare of every person, with the government deciding who gets life, what ones get liberty, what ones get to keep their property. This loss of limited government, which has been in process for almost a century now, is now so familiar to Americans that anyone who disagrees with it is regarded as completely uncaring and a fool. So when the House of Representatives passed the $2 trillion stimulus package, the first one — there's more to come, folks — but the first one, there were just a handful of congressmen who stood against it, and only one, Thomas Massey of Kentucky, who actually made the House vote on the bill. That, in my opinion, was the beginning of the end of America. as the one nation in the world who recognized that only by creating stored work could a society prosper. And once that bridge is crossed, why not give money to pay off college loan debt? Pay companies as long as they keep workers on the payroll, even though there's nothing to do. Why not increase the minimum wage to $1,000 an hour? Where, you may ask, is the biblical basis for the assertions that your pastor is making right now? 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Even when we were with you, we would give you this command. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. For we hear that some among you walk in idleness, not busy at work, but busy bodies. Now such persons we command and encourage in the Lord Jesus Christ to do their work quietly and to earn their own living. Or for the Old Testament, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. You see, a plan that involves meaningful, not made-up work, and the potential for innovation and ingenuity, giving the poor dignity and a pathway forward. What are we doing? I know gleaning isn't the answer to the modern issue. I know that. But what are we doing to innovate, to create meaningful work for the poor all around us? Sometimes it's easier just to throw a few dollars at the poor and think we've done our duty. Brothers and sisters, the reason why the early church was so radical was that not that they didn't understand the value of work, but that they understood the value of something greater, that they were here to glorify God and to serve the world the gospel of Jesus Christ. And they would spend anything of their own stuff in order to accomplish that goal. And as we head into rougher waters, I believe, in the life of our nation, it will become more important for every believer in Jesus so to consider their own role in these matters. Father, thank you for the opportunity for us to consider the role of government. You've established it. We pray for our government, federal, state, and local, asking for your wisdom to be poured out upon them in these tumultuous days. But more than that, help us to have our hands open to serve and help and love. Help us to recognize the value of every person and the opportunity that every person has, no matter what their level of intellect or emotional stability, or what, every person is made in your image and is valuable. Help us so to love the poor. In Jesus' name, amen.